You're listening to Power Plays, the podcast charting how important decisions about the internet, its infrastructure, and its institutions have been made. Here's your host, Aiden Ferdeline.
Welcome to Power Plays. I'm Aiden Ferdeline. Today on the show, we're speaking with Richard Hill. He is a fascinating individual with a long professional background in technology, telecommunications, and internet governance. He spent a decade with the International Telecommunications Union dealing with numbering and tariffing issues, as well as economic and policy issues. And on a personal level, he's someone who I respect greatly because of how he forms his positions, listens to evidence, and keeps atop of his brief. A listener note, we recorded this conversation in November 2020, and I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. Richard, hi. Before we get started, I wanted to begin with an icebreaker. It's something that I always ask people on Power Plays, and that is, what is a contrarian thought that you have about business or culture that others might disagree with you on?
That's a difficult one for two reasons. I used to have this gigantic list of contrarian thoughts, but over time, although my thoughts haven't changed, they're getting less and less contrarian. So, which is worrisome, or maybe not. Let me see. I think the one I'd like to toss out here, which actually I have heard from others, so it's not 100% contrary. We all are happy because of all this innovation and technology, and the price of computers goes down, and today's smartphone is so powerful, et cetera, et cetera. But maybe too much innovation is actually creating problems. Somebody actually said quite some time ago that was wonderful that we used all this science and technology to put a man or a person on the moon in 69, I think it was. And what's been the biggest innovation after that? Twitter and Facebook. Is that really what we wanted? Okay, that's not true. It wasn't the only big innovation. Since then, that's making the point. We seem to be doing these things which have unforeseen effects. And now more and more people everywhere, civil society as well as government, are becoming conscious of the fact that there are some unforeseen negative side effects of the way that we're deploying these technologies. So it's not the technology itself, but the way we're deploying it. And it's maybe because being deployed too fast. So maybe actually this permissionless innovation that some people refer to is not such a great thing. And we should have constraints on innovation. We do, for example, for pharmaceuticals. You can't now go out and say, I've got a vaccine, everybody take it. You have to go through a rather elaborate process of proving that the vaccine is safe and effective before you're allowed to deploy it. I don't know. That's my contrarian thought. Maybe we need more constraints on technology and its deployment and not fewer.
That's a great point. I think I agree with you that this idea of moving fast and breaking things has had its day and hasn't always helped create a world that we want to live in. So, Richard, you spent a large chunk of your career in Switzerland and over a decade of your career working at the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union. I'm curious, though, what brought you to Switzerland and eventually to Geneva and into the world of telecommunications in the first place?
So that's a little complicated. Despite my name, I'm actually Italian, or rather half. My mother was Italian from the south of Italy, from Naples. And there are blonde people in the south of Italy because those Vikings got around. And the south of Italy was conquered, actually, in the Middle Ages by Normans, who were descendants of the Vikings. So my mother was from Naples, and my father was American, and he was in the army during World War II. They met in Naples. I was born in Trieste in the north of Italy, lived a little bit in Germany, then wound up in San Francisco for a while. Then they split up and my mother moved back to Italy and I grew up in Rome, but then I went to university in Boston. And actually, I always wanted to go back to Europe. And I studied statistics at university. And it turns out that in Switzerland at that time, there were hardly no statisticians. And so I was able to get a job with a company called AC Nielsen, which is a marketing, fairly big, well-known marketing company in Lucerne. But I had visited Geneva when I was much younger, when I was a teenager. And I liked Geneva because of the lake. And it's a beautiful place, as those who've been there know. And so when an opportunity came up at the Hewlett-Packard in Geneva, I jumped on it. and moved to Geneva, and I've been here ever since. So how did I get into telecoms? So although I studied statistics, I was already working as a computer programmer at the time, and then later continued to be actually employed as in computers. I did work for 4 years as a statistician with Nielsen, but the bulk of my career has been in information technology. And I was, when I was managing a computer center for Hewlett-Packard, we obviously were communicating with other computer centers, although it wasn't that obvious at the time, using some of the, you're too young for that, but modems that were 1200 baud and the whistle on the analog line and things like that. And in fact, even when I was at MIT, we were using remote computers. At the time, actually they were typewriters, electric typewriters that were tied to the main computer. So I'd always been in computers, and as computers were communicating, of course, I started getting involved in technology. And when I was at Hewlett-Packard, after managing that computer center, I wound up actually in the Hewlett-Packard telecom team, which at the time was deploying a TCP/IP internally. Hewlett-Packard, it was funny, Hewlett-Packard was selling X25 outside, but using TCP/IP inside. And actually, that team had at that time deployed the largest internet at the time. There was a company, it wasn't an external internet, but it had actually the most connected computers of any in the internet at the time. So I got familiar with the internet at the very early stages. And then after that, actually, I wound up with a cellular company, mobile company, which was a startup at the time called Orange Switzerland. It was loosely tied to the Orange that was in the UK and elsewhere. And then I was on the computer side, but still basically deep into telecoms. And then from that, I moved into ITU, because actually for what they were trying to do at the time, the work that was ongoing, they wanted somebody who knew computers as well as telecoms. And so I got even deeper into telecoms. But I'm coming at telecoms as a nethead. I met a lot of bellheads when I was at Orange, but I'm coming at it from the nethead point of view.
Can you speak a little bit about the projects that you were working on in the 80s and 90s, just to contextualize for our listeners your background, and so they can understand the transition you would later make into what you were doing at the ITU?
Yeah, sure. That's a very good point. So let's start at the beginning. My first contact with computers was something that some people have heard of, but probably most of you haven't seen, punch cards. And that's why, by the way, it's 8 bits, because they had eight columns, and they had 80 rows, and they had 80 columns. And you'd have a machine, and you'd type the stuff up, and then you'd put it into a reader, and then you'd get a printout, and you'd see whether your program worked or not and did the calculations or not. I wound up actually as my first job, programming for a research project that was doing a software for econometric analysis. And being MIT, that was a very advanced setup. And they had actually one of the world's most advanced computers at the time, which was a digital computer, which had twice as much memory as any other computer ever built. It had 64K. Wow. Back then, this would have been around 72, 73. And that computer was on time sharing, which meant that you didn't use these punch cards anymore. You were actually connected through this mechanical typewriter. And then later we had screens and stuff like that. So that was the first link. And then later when I was at Hewlett-Packard, we had this issue of how to connect the office. In that case, there were offices in the Middle East and in Athens in Greece to the central office, regional center that we had in Geneva, because some of the processing for the orders and shipments was done in Geneva and then sent back off to the US, et cetera. So being Hewlett-Packard is a very large company, very decentralized with different factories producing different things and so on. So you have to have very good internal communications in order to make things work. Prior to that, they'd been using telex or whatever, but by the time I was there, they had their own computer network of some kind. And that was really core to the company's business. And you could really see at the company level exactly what we're now seeing at the international level with these integrated supply chains that span the world. And you want seamless communications, and a lot of it is asynchronous. You don't call up the phone, or you send some structured message and something happens, and then they send something back, which could be a product.
And the networks at the time that Hewlett-Packard were using, were they proprietary networks, or was this the early days of open networking?
Yeah, so that's actually when the sort of interesting things happened. As most people know, at that time, IBM was the dominant supplier by far. and not just in big computers, but also medium and fairly small computers. And of course, many of IBM's customers had the same issue and they wanted to interconnect. And so IBM developed its own network, which was called at that time SNA. And the other manufacturers competing with IBM, if they wanted to compete, they had to be able to do that. So Digital Equipment, which was the biggest competitor of IBM at the time, had DECnet. And then everybody else, including Hewlett-Packard, and there were other people at the time, names that have disappeared now, like Honeywell and so forth, they said, well, why don't we all get together and do something against IBM? And they actually managed to get Digital to come in too. And so they developed what was going to be a kind of common open standard protocol. And they were doing that through the International Standards Organization, ISO, the International Electrotechnical Committee, IEC, and the ITU, through a thing called JTC1, Joint Technical Committee 1. And that was called the Open System Interface, of which some bits actually still survive. The certificates that are used for HTTPS, the X500 certificates, come out of that work and some other things that are still being used. But then TCP/IP came along, and so that all got derailed. But really, it was this need to respond to the business requirements of large customers that were using large computers but wanted to be able to integrate them. Of course, that was predated somewhat by the military requirement, as communications is extremely important for the military and to defend against ballistic missiles and so on. You want to integrate your radar warning stations with stations that are farther away that can do something, et cetera. So actually, a lot of the history of computing, if you look at it, came out of a requirement to satisfy military needs in terms of computing power. But let's not stick to the civilian side.
When I think about how telecommunications policy was originally set, if I think about, for example, spectrum policy, that electromagnetic spectrum is a finite resource and therefore it must be managed as a public good, I feel like there has been a shift away from policy that was planned, controlled, and supposedly for the public benefit, and towards more of a reliance on market processes. What is the right of private enterprise, or not, to be fettered by regulation? Is that something that you started to see in your career as early as when you were at Hewlett-Packard?
Yeah, I was right into that because that happened in the 70s, which was at the kind of beginning of my career. And in fact, when I was, for example, at MIT, but also at Hewlett-Packard, one of the things we suffered from is the inability to establish high bandwidth connections because of regulation. And there are two kinds of regulation. One is, at that time, this is well known about AT&T, but the other phone companies did it too. They wouldn't let you attach equipment to their network unless they had certified it, et cetera, which is not bad per se, but it was bad in detail. I'll come back to that. And they also had the monopoly on the big lines, on the leased lines, connecting on the pipes, and they would collude on the price so that you couldn't get those lines at a decent price because they, being a monopoly, they were making money. So what went wrong? Let's take the AT&T case, which is the clearest, but it's true elsewhere. I don't think that it was bad that these were regulated monopolies because I think a lot of these markets are natural monopolies. How many roads are you going to have between Beirut and Damascus? One. So either you let a robber baron run it, or you say, no, we don't like that one guy gets to make all that money. Let's make that a public good, and then everybody can use it at a shared price. And that was the basic idea behind roads and telecommunications from ancient times. It's a public infrastructure. And it's also used for imperial reasons, but that's something else. And the idea was, and it's the same for the mail. The idea is that, okay, first there's private mail. Okay, then there's the royal mail. And then, well, wait a minute, the king is there for everybody, so let's make it the public mail. And in the U.S., which never had a king, it was always the public mail. But what happened is that they, people who were supposed to be regulating AT&T and France Telecom and everybody else, it was the same, weren't really paying enough attention, or they really didn't care that much. So what happened is that these monopolies started not using their monopoly profits in ways that were actually helping the users, but to do other things. So in some cases, it was good, like Bell Labs. AT&T was funding Bell Labs, which gave us practically every innovation that we have, including transistors, out of its monopoly profits. But they were also paying high salaries, and not just on top, but to everybody, and they ensured very comfortable returns on their stocks and bonds. So it was a preferred investment vehicle, et cetera, et cetera. But that had nothing to do with telecom. So for the telecom user, the prices were too high and the innovation was too low. Now, since it's a regulated monopoly, the regulator could have, in theory, fixed that. The regulator could have come in and said, wait a minute, guys, we don't agree with that. You have to have more innovation. So yeah, do allow external devices to be attached, et cetera. Stop being so restrictive. And by the way, your prices, we don't agree, lower them. If you know something about France, that actually happened at that period. I think it was in the 80s. It used to, at that time, it like took 3 years or something to get a telephone line in most French cities. And they had a change in government and the government said, this is nonsense. And so they had a big push and suddenly they made a leap. And it became much faster to get a telephone. The prices dropped. And that's where they started investing in Minitel. Everybody actually had the phone telephone directory online on a little terminal. This is way before the internet. So proper regulation could have resulted in change. But for various reasons, that didn't happen, in particular in the U.S. And it's a mystery. It's not clear because the U.S. was on a path where AT&T and IBM were going to dominate the combined telecom and computer spectrum. And suddenly, the government threw a bomb into that by breaking up AT&T, by also pushing IBM, and all these new actors came out. So that had a very positive effect, which prices went way down and we got much more innovation. And if they hadn't done that, we wouldn't have the internet as we know it. We'd have something else, but it wouldn't be today's internet. But I'm a big believer in the pendulum kind of thing. So I think that they went too far. And now it's time to go back. So I'll just give you one example of a strange, perverse side effect of deregulation, which I know about because of my work at ITU. At ITU, I was basically the ICANN of telephone numbers. It doesn't work the same way, though, because basically each country gets a telephone number. And by country, you mean something that is recognized by the UN. So it's on the official list of UN states. And the function I had is to decide whether it's 123 or 345. Basically. And now, of course, most of them have been assigned long ago, but every now and then a new one comes up. And there are other numbers which people don't know about, which are very important, which are used in mobile telephony and other things for which there's fairly active work going on about how to assign them, allocate them, et cetera, and who gets them. So the perverse side effect I'm mentioning is Papua New Guinea became an independent country, and so they get their country code. Okay, fine. So I give them the country code, and it's published, and everybody knows about it. And for years, people would call me up from the U.S. saying, I can't dial the Papua New Guinea number. Why not? I did a little bit of research. It turns out because in many countries, when they privatized and deregulated, they didn't think to put in a new regulation, which hadn't been there before, saying, oh, and by the way, you must route all country codes. Because unlike the internet, there's no central automatic root file, which drives all the interconnections. We know in the DNS, there's the authoritative root file, and then there are all these root servers, et cetera, et cetera. And when ICANN makes a change, it gets updated in the master server and then replicated around the world. That's not how it works in telephony. When I assign the country code for Papua New Guinea, the ITU publishes it on the website. Great. And now every operator in the world has to be willing to go to the ITU's website, grab that, and program it. Okay, mostly they have agreements with other operators. So the big operators do that and the little ones simply follow, but some of them don't. And the reason they don't is because the root has to be manually coded. Again, unlike the internet, there's no automatic propagation of roots. And that costs money, doesn't cost very much. If you're gonna get revenue from one call a year to Papua New Guinea, it isn't gonna pay even for the small amount of time to program it. So you don't do it. Now, some countries don't have that. For example, in Switzerland, it is mandatory that every operator allows you to call every country code that is published by ITU. But that's not true in all countries. Mostly it's not a problem because for commercial interests, all the operators are coding. But there are these corner cases that come up. And I think that's an example of where actually we need more regulation. We went too far in deregulating. Europe, I think, is better. I think their European regulatory model is not so bad. But the U.S., I think, is off the walls, as anybody who knows about net neutrality will understand that the U.S. regulatory environment is not healthy. And many countries are confused and don't know what to do.
That's really fascinating. It never occurred to me that there was not a central automatic equivalent of the A root server, but for telephony.
They keep pushing this thing, oh, the telephony is this hierarchical top-down, blah, blah. Yeah, it's government-driven. Then in the end, it's actually in some ways, the naming and addressing is more decentralized than for the internet. Other things are less centralized. I'll tell you a funny anecdote, which really happened to me. So when I was at Orange, I was the infrastructure, IT infrastructure managers, not the top computer manager, but still pretty high up in the company. And it happened that all the senior management had been traveling, and my boss's boss were also traveling. And at that time, this is a mobile network, but SS7. At that time, we were using Swisscom to provide the SS7 connectivity. And you can't make mobile phone calls without SS7. So in Switzerland, we were using the national. We had our own SS7. And for international, we were using Swisscom. And Swisscom had a computer problem, one of these things that isn't supposed to happen, nonstop systems, et cetera, et cetera. They did a software upgrade. And because the software was the same on every single replicated system, actually the redundancy didn't work. And so they were actually down for, I think it was like 16 hours. So they couldn't make any calls at all. We could still make all our calls, but we couldn't make international calls. And so I was the senior technical guy on the spot. And people said, well, what do we do? Because our customers now can't make international calls. We couldn't call our managers who are traveling because they're all on our mobile network, so they couldn't be reached. And so I was it. And I said, can't we reprogram? So instead of going through Swisscom, can we go through France Telecom or Deutsche Telekom or whatever? And the guys came back and said, yeah, this is all manual. So what we have to do is actually we have sent faxes to like 20 operators to say, watch out. We're no longer routing this way. We're routing that way. And I said, how long is that going to take? They said about 8 hours. And I said, I'll take the risk. Let's just wait. And it turned out to be the right decision. But you know, that shows you how this is much less centralized and much more manual than the internet, which is logical, right? Because the internet is more recent. So of course it had more automation built into it from the start. Telephony is still a lot of legacy.
I want to touch a bit upon what was the impetus for the privatization and liberalization of telecoms in, I guess, from the 70s through to the 90s, and the internet OSI standards war. I'll let you explain that, but at a high level, long-running debating computer science between engineers, organizations, and nations is over which communications protocol would result in the best and most robust computer networks. TCP/IP ultimately won out over OSI. What do you think went well here, and what should have been done differently?
I don't know about should have been done differently because it's normal we learn from our mistakes, but let's say what should we now do to correct what isn't optimal or to improve things. So the driver for privatization and liberalization was clear. There was a lack of innovation and the prices were too high. The push came primarily from big companies like my former employer, Hewlett-Packard, because those companies had very high telecom costs because they have a lot of employees and also because they're very international. And also they wanted to be more innovative. So we wanted to be able to deploy high-end modems, which we knew existed. An engineering company, obviously they knew that the stuff, they weren't building them themselves, but they knew that the stuff could be built and you couldn't do it. So basically it was a lobby of the large corporate users, much more than individual users, who pushed saying, look, this isn't working. And for various reasons, the regulator was unable to solve that. And so the solution was seen to break up the monopoly, privatize it, liberalize it. And it did have the intended effect of favoring innovation and lowering prices. So this kind of coincided with what I had mentioned earlier, which was a bunch of computer manufacturers had allied to develop networking standards that would compete against the IBM's networking standard, SNA, because they wanted to be able to compete on the network side with IBM as well as on the computing side. And in parallel to that, the U.S. Department of Defense had funded the development of research into connecting computers for military purposes, which turned out to be TCP/IP. But then, of course, it turned out it's all the same thing. And so the question became, okay, what should we use? Should we use TCP/IP or should we use that OSI protocol, as you mentioned, which was the one developed by all these computer manufacturers under ITU, ISO, IEC. And actually, it's paradoxical. All the governments of the world, including the U.S. government, were pushing OSI. There was actually a formal procurement standard saying all U.S. government agencies have to buy OSI. But as the Defense Department is a state within the state in the U.S., not just in the U.S., also elsewhere. So they didn't care about that. And they said, we're going to do our thing, which is TCP/IP. And they were able actually to outspend, the U.S. Department of Defense was able to outspend the entire rest of the world in terms of deploying computer networks at the time. So TCP/IP became very widely deployed. And then I can take the specific case of Hewlett-Packard, but it's the case of many other companies. Because Hewlett-Packard is big on the defense business, they had to communicate with the Department of Defense. So they had to start having TCP/IP inside. And once they started having TCP/IP inside, it became fairly clear, well, what are we going to do? We're not going to have X25 and OSI and TCP/IP. Let's just go with TCP/IP. It has some advantages. In particular, it's clear that TCP/IP is a brilliant invention. And so it was able to create these great data networks. It had two advantages and disadvantages. It didn't foresee billing. So that was even annoying within Hewlett-Packard because we had previously been on the polluter pays principle. If you put data into the network, you pay for it. Suddenly, we couldn't do that anymore. So flat rate. So inside a company, flat rate means free. What are you going to do? You just give the network to everybody, give them as much bandwidth as they need, and that's it. Okay, fine. That's had the very deleterious consequence jumping forward that the only model we seem to have for funding the internet is advertising. Targeted advertising, right? Which means exploiting people's personal data, which, as we know, has huge implications, and everybody now understands that this is really not a good idea. So clearly that was a stupid mistake. We're going to create a network, and we're going to have no mechanism whatsoever for measuring the traffic on the network so that we can allocate the costs on the basis of usage. So I think that was a fundamental flaw. And it will, no criticism of the designers, because the designers were designing a private military network. This was a network to be used by the military. Of course, the military doesn't care about costs. They have other problems. The other big failure was lack of security. And again, it's because of the design brief was, give us a network that can connect military computers. Okay, by definition, all those military computers are secure and are in secure sites. And so you don't have to worry about network security. So there is no network security, and there still isn't. And it's proving extremely hard to retrofit. Whereas one of the reasons that OSI didn't get deployed is because it had billing and because it had security. So of course, it was much more expensive to implement, more cumbersome, et cetera, so it couldn't compete against TCP/IP if people didn't care about security. Now, as long as you were connecting mainframes, okay, security is not a big deal. But then Bill Gates came along and deliberately, and I speak with knowledge, deliberately gave us an operating system that was totally insecure, even though at that time, everybody knew how to build secure operating systems. Why did he do that? Because it's cheaper, right? It required a smaller chip and less memory to have a system that didn't distinguish between supervisor mode and the user mode, if you like. Now, that didn't basically have any security at all. And so that drove out CPM, which was a little bit more complicated because it had some semblance of security. Now you take totally insecure devices attached to an insecure network, and what do you get? What we have. Spam, phishing, viruses, Trojans, you name it. So we lost this public infrastructure idea. So coming back to another thread that you mentioned, which is important, roads and communication mechanisms, be it telegram, telephone, whatever, were always viewed as something that the government provides, well, the king or the noble, but then in more evolved times that the government provides for the use of all citizens. And it's also strategic because it allows you to project power. And there is some thinking that maybe the dominance of TCP/IP is not accidental. Maybe that was deliberate at the time, because of course they do get an advantage from having a lot of control over the infrastructure and most of the data passing through the US and so on, as we know from the Snowden revelations regarding the NSA. But there was always this concept of, yeah, it's a public infrastructure, less in the US, of course, because of its peculiar history, but certainly strong in Europe. It's a public infrastructure. It has to be a service available to everybody under fair conditions and so on. And that kind of, we lost that with privatization and liberalization. Again, Europe, it's not a big problem, but in the US, it resurfaces with the net neutrality debate. So it's the question of, yeah, okay, how much money are you allowed to make from the last mile? Basically, that's what it's about, right? Because if you don't think that the last mile is public and therefore it must be available to everybody at a reasonable price, it's my wire. I can do anything I like with it. In fact, the guy from AT&T actually said that. It's my cable and I'm going to charge what I damn want for it. Another anecdote that you'll find amusing, because you've seen this expression repeatedly when you talk about making fundamental changes to the internet: if it isn't broken, don't fix it. You know, how many times have we heard that one? Actually, if you go back to the 70s, that's exactly what AT&T said when it was trying to block the adoption of TCP/IP. Because, of course, all the big telcos and all those big computer manufacturers were against TCP/IP. And that's why it's called the OSI Wars, because there really was a struggle between the more innovative TCP/IP type people and the old stream telco and computer people who were saying, oh, we have this OSI and so on. And of course, AT&T would say, well, telephone network works fine. Why do you want to replace it with this strange stuff that we don't know anything about? If it isn't broken, don't fix it. The circle repeats. And I don't know if you've noticed, but many people have. The lack of innovation in the telephone network was partly due to anti-competitive decisions, but also partly due to the fact that you've got a gigantic installed base. It gets very difficult to replace things. It's expensive, and it might be dangerous because you change something, you don't know if it works. And of course, the internet is now suffering from exactly the same problems. You can't get IPv6 in because you have this gigantic IPv4 base. And for example, when they introduced multilingual character sets, they didn't dare to go to 8-bit ASCII because they were, or 16 even, because they weren't sure it was going to work. So they came up with this strange kludge of the IDNs because, okay, look, we're not sure. You have this giant installed base. Let's stick to 7-bit and make sure that everything works. So when you have a huge infrastructure deployed, it gets very difficult to change it. And again, I think that's some of the lessons we have to learn. And how can you change that? In the end, sometimes because of externalities, people will not make decisions that are good for the common good because they don't see the externality. I was just in a talk on the pandemic. Why doesn't everybody wear masks? Because I don't think that I'm at risk, so I'm not going to wear a mask. But wait a minute, I might be putting somebody else at risk. And people don't necessarily integrate that into their calculations. So at some point, you need an external force to internalize the externalities and, for example, impose masks or whatever. And I think here, for example, security is a typical case. It's well understood now that the market will never give us enough security because of market failures, in particular, information asymmetry. How do you know which antivirus is good for you? You can't know. And how do you know how long the passwords should be and how often you change them? Yeah, you have all this advice, but you're not a technical expert. And very few people actually are able to make the appropriate risk-benefit trade-off. And the other is externalities. If my PC is insecure, maybe I don't care because I don't have anything on it. But wait a minute. If it gets a virus that then affects your PC, that's going to bother you. But I don't care about that because I don't see you. Or the famous example of the big marketing, big online shopping company that loses the credit card data. Okay, they don't care, right? Nothing happened from their point of view. They lose reputation. But each individual user has to go off and get a new credit card. Maybe they don't pay for it, but they do indirectly through their credit card fees because the credit card company, it does have a cost. So somehow there is a real cost there, which is not seen by the entity who didn't have sufficient security. And this is well known everywhere else. In pharmaceuticals, we have mandatory safety standards, electrical appliances, cars, airplanes, anything. You name it, we have mandatory safety and security standards because we know that people, first, can't evaluate that by themselves, and second, their externalities. And in ICTs, this is not just about the network or the internet. This is in general. And ICTs were blind to that. So going back to MS-DOS, that should never have been allowed to be deployed, at least not connected to a network. Okay, if you want to have totally insecure devices not connected, fine. If you thought about it, the governments would have said, no, wait a minute, you cannot connect insecure devices to an insecure network because that's going to lead to catastrophe. But we have to start thinking now, okay, can't change the past, but how do we go forward? And in fact, that's happening because now what I'm saying now is it's not only me saying that, as things are being said clearly by a number of players.
Thanks. There's so much to unpack there. I really like the anecdote that you brought up that if it isn't broken, don't fix it. However, what if it is broken? How then do we go about fixing it? And what are the vehicles that we have to do that? I'm wondering if you think, based upon the decade that you spent working at the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union, whether you think that the ITU is a vehicle that will be able to bring about some of the changes that are necessary, be that in telephony, whether that be in the development of networks, communication protocols, some of the capacity. Is the ITU going to be able to reinvent itself to stay relevant? Will the ITU change? Or do we need some sort of new structure or new mechanism of bringing about cooperation on some of these issues?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So the short answer is I think that the ITU should be able to reinvent itself, but I'm not convinced that it will be able to do, and I'll explain why. I'll start with a Booz Allen Hamilton study, which was, I think it must be like about 10, 15 years ago, which made an attempt to come up with the world's most enduring institutions. And number one was the U.S. Constitution, which is fair enough, because as it's the oldest Constitution. Maybe that's a problem, as we see with the current elections, but still, it's endured with not that many changes, whereas other countries have completely thrown out and had it new constitutions, or in the case of the UK, it's a complicated evolutionary process. And another one they had, I forget if it was number two or three on the list, was actually the ITU, because the ITU goes back to 1865. So it's an extremely old institution, and it has had huge transformations. And basically, the ITU has survived by growing. So initially, it was telegraphy, and then it was wireless telegraphy was added, and then telephony was added, and then modern networks started to be added. But that's where it got stuck because of these OSI wars. So ITU was on a path to produce the network standards that would be used around the world, et cetera, et cetera. And then we had these OSI wars, and of course, everything shifted to the IETF on the one side. And although people don't notice it so much on the wireless side, which is very important, of course, mobile telephony, mostly for reasons that the US was trying to push its technology and didn't succeed to do that in the ITU, and the Europeans succeeded by creating ETSI. So as all of the wireless stuff is ETSI, and even more, from my point of view, pernicious, actually a lot of the important standards, for example, on roaming and billing are done by the GSMA. 3GPP and things like that. And that's an industry group. So again, this is part of the privatization trend. Governments are slow and inefficient, which is true. So let's let industry do it because they're going to be fast, which is true sometimes. ICANN is not particularly fast, but that's for other reasons. But wait a minute, what's the driving goal of industry? Maximize profit for who? For the shareholders. Okay, if you have a lot of shareholders, maybe that's okay. But in a lot of these industries, you only have one shareholder, Bezos or Zuckerberg, right? You don't, or Ma. It's not only one, but individuals have huge disproportionate. So, and you count them, there's only about a dozen of these guys. Okay, mobile network is a little bit more complicated, but still there's very high level of concentration at the top. There's a few really big operators. And so you're now letting organizations and people make decisions where their motivation is to increase their profits. Whereas government, okay, there are lots of corrupt governments, but in theory, the government is not trying to do that. It's trying to increase the well-being of everybody. And that's one of the reasons the governments are so slow, because they're trying to figure out, ooh, what's better for everybody? It's much easier to say, what's going to increase my share price? That's much easier to figure out. What's that going to be? What's going to be drive out competition or collude with other people in some way to raise prices and so on? Have ever more patents? You've heard the current mobile phones have 1,000 patents in them, you know, something like that. It's completely crazy. So allowing industry to make decisions has an advantage. It's going to be quicker and more innovative, but it has a disadvantage. The decisions are not necessarily in the common good. And that's what's being seen pretty clearly. Now, if we outsource control of content to Facebook, are they going to do what's in the common good? They're going to do what increases Facebook's profitability. And you can't criticize them for doing that because we live in a capitalist system. And in a capitalist system, private companies are supposed to maximize profits. So you can't tell Zuckerberg, hey, you're maximizing profits, that's bad. That's stupid. Of course he's maximizing profits. That's what he's supposed to do. That's what the law says he's supposed to do. So you need to find a different system. And I think that you need to recognize that some of this stuff has to be not necessarily run by the government, but at least regulated by the government. We have the great example of attempting to privatize energy distribution in the US with the famous Enron failure. It said, oh, let's let the private sector produce energy. Okay, fine. But let's also let them distribute it. Wait a minute. You cannot have competition on the wires that carry electricity into your house. So it isn't going to work. So you're going to have a private monopoly. So either you regulate it very closely or you don't. And if you don't, you're going to get a scandal because these guys are going to maximize profits and it's going to hurt the individual users, which wasn't the purpose of the exercise. The purpose of the exercise was to make it better for individual users. So we were into that fundamental conundrum. What is a public good that must be available to everybody and delivered to everybody? And I would submit that a basic level of connectivity, but even email and search is now in that category. So these should no longer be entirely controlled by private companies, provided by private companies, yes, of course. But there has to be a set of rules that make it available to everybody at a fair price.
This is a really interesting concept. And it's something that you wrote about in your piece calling for a new convention on data in cyberspace, where you said that it would appear that data was poised to revolutionize social and economic life, much like steam power and mechanization did 3 centuries ago. And you said that we're simultaneously in a race to capitalize on this technology while developing means of controlling it. And what I found really interesting in your piece was that you didn't necessarily succumb to the prevailing view that the multi-stakeholder model of internet governance must reign supreme and unchallenged. You said that there are alternative ways of governing the internet. Could you speak a bit about what they would look like, and maybe just briefly introduce your article for those who have not read it yet?
Yeah, and I'll come back to the ITU because I realize now I didn't really answer your question about whether the ITU could or would be able to provide the framework, but I'll discuss that in this framework of the convention where it fits quite well. The first comment, this idea that data is the information revolution actually comes from our colleague Parminder Jeet Singh, who most people know very well, as he's the one that introduced me to that idea. And I think it's true. We had the agricultural revolution, which changed everything. Then we had the industrial revolution that changed everything. And now we're having the information revolution, which clearly is changing everything. And just as it took a long time to figure out how to govern the agriculture in a reasonable way, as opposed to a few big landowners and kings exploiting everybody else, and also the Industrial Revolution as just having the robber barons exploit all these underpaid workers. How do we now handle data so that the value of data is equitably distributed, as opposed to essentially all of it going to 4 people in Silicon Valley and 2 people in China, which is the current situation, almost literally. And so we need to figure that out. So actually, personally, I am an anarchist, but only in theory, not in practice, because I don't see how anarchy works on a big scale. And it works reasonably well at small scale, but not at a big scale. So in a way, I agree with Milton Muller, also a colleague known to everybody. Well, ideally, we want governance by the people for the people. But how do we get there? And Milton is saying, we don't really like the nation state because the nation state does lots of terrible things, which is true, it does. Let's do something else. Okay, but what's something else? So theoretically, I think we ought to have the equivalent of the Swiss or the US Federation. They have their defects, but they have lots of good things in their governance model at the world level. So we should have a global federation where people elect the equivalent of a US House and the equivalent of a US Senate by some mechanism, et cetera. This isn't going to happen in your lifetime or in your children's lifetime. We're not going to get there. So what do we do? So what we have is the nation state. So either we say, let's get rid of the nation state because these guys are evil. For example, they tried to prevent TCP/IP. They didn't succeed. They weren't really that bad because although they tried to stop TCP/IP, they didn't succeed. And then let private companies do everything. And this has actually been explicitly called for, that in the multi-stakeholder model, as the stakeholders should have equal standing. And so the private companies can veto decisions by governments. Wait a minute, then how do we get the public interest? Because companies are looking out for the public interest because of competition. True, if you have a competitive market. But if you don't have a competitive market, which is the case for most things in ICTs because of network effects and economies of scale, Google is dominant search, then that doesn't work. I don't like Google. What am I supposed to do? Yes, I have tried the other ones. They're actually, for me, not as good. Maybe for somebody else, they're as good, but not for me. So what am I going to do? Why do I use Microsoft Word? Because everybody else uses Microsoft Word. Have I tried OpenOffice? Yes. As long as the document is simple, it works fine. When you start doing something complicated, if the other party doesn't have OpenOffice, it doesn't work. You cannot rely on competition to ensure governance. The other problem with this multi-stakeholder model is that, as we all know, companies are very influential at the national level on governments. So by actually allowing governments, industry to participate directly at the international level, you're giving them 2 bites of the apple because they get to influence national policy and then they get to come in and also influence it directly at the international level. And in parentheses, that's one of the big problems with WTO. WTO is far too dominated by corporate interests. Not that they participate directly in WTO, but they have so much influence at the national level that in fact, most WTO agreements are done in the favor of large multinational corporations and that wound up not really helping people very much. But that's a side discussion. Now, coming back to ITU was actually the original, quote, multi-stakeholder institution because after it was created in 1865, governments only, and then 7 years later, I think it was in St. Petersburg in 1872, they realized, oh, this doesn't work because we're discussing technical things. Should we use Morse code or not Morse code? And what is the level of signal that should be going down the wires and stuff like that? We're government bureaucrats. We don't understand this stuff. Let's bring in the private sector, which is actually running these things. Okay, they were government monopolies, but still, that was private sector. So you had the telegraph companies. And so they allowed those people to come in as basically speaking observers, we'd say today. And so the ITU has recognized since 1872 this category of sector member, which are private companies. And depending on the type of decision, they have more or less influence. So for budget matters, they have zero influence. For technical matters, basically, they're running things unless some government wants to intervene for political reasons. So that model actually has existed for a long time. And if you know any the history of multi-stakeholder, that actually it also exists in other walks of life. It's not just in telecoms that it's existed. So the right form of it is not a problem. As my colleague Norbert Bollo, who is also fairly well known, and I have written, what we think is that the multi-stakeholder process is excellent and, in fact, indispensable for consultation. But then when you actually get to a decision which may affect public policy or is in the public interest, really that should be reserved to democratic governments. Now, it's true that most governments are not democratic, and I don't count the U.S. as being a democratic government personally. It has the trappings of democracy, but not the substance, but that's a different discourse. But, okay, what's the alternative, right? Again, they say, okay, most governments are not democratic, but wait a minute, private companies, which is the alternative, that's the least democratic structure that we know of. Employees don't vote for who gets to be the boss. Employees can't even, unless they're heavily unionized, negotiate regarding their salaries or their working conditions. That's a pure top-down structure. There's the owners, the shareholders, choose the management, and then the management manages. Top-down, totally, entirely. Okay, in some very good companies like Hewlett-Packard, you get to upward communication and consultation, et cetera. But still, it's a completely top-down structure. And again, what's the purpose of a company? To make money for the owners. Wait a minute. How's this going to give us the public interest? So there's a problem, right? The current structure of the nation states, United Nations, ITU, et cetera, is suboptimal for sure. But what's the alternative? So I think we have to work on it. For example, in ITU, clearly they were too closed and not sufficiently transparent. That's improved. It has not improved enough, but we should continue to push that. And that brings me to the issue of why will the ITU, I think, not be able to evolve to provide the kind of governance that we need. One reason is because many of its member governments don't actually want that. It's clear, right? The Chinese or Russian or Arab concept of how to run the world is probably not well aligned with ours. So you're going to be a blockage there. But there's something more pernicious, which is basically that the US is sabotaging. And it's not just the ITU, as Trump pulled out of the World Health Organization, is sabotaging the World Trade Organization, et cetera, et cetera. People dream it'll be better under Biden. No, the form will change. The glove will be velvet, but the hand will be the same steel hand because Obama was doing similar things. It just wasn't as visible. Basically, the US is still in an imperialistic mode and wishes to dominate. So it will sabotage any international institution that it cannot dominate. And for structural reasons, because of the way the ITU is organized, the US, although it is very influential, still more influential than China, despite what some people say, it doesn't control things to its liking. And so it simply blocks things in the ITU. And because it's an influential country and a major contributor to the budget, it's difficult to get around that. So with the on the one hand, the U.S. blocking things, and on the other hand, some authoritarian countries are pushing things that we don't like, it's difficult to find a consensus in the ITU. So for anything that is not highly technical, basically you don't move forward. Now, to me, having lived the Cold War, it's strange because I never thought the Cold War, I was born in 1949, I never thought the Cold War would end in my lifetime. But I certainly never imagined it would revive in my lifetime. And I remember I wasn't really in the international organizations back then, but I had some contact with them in various contexts. Basically what happened, and you've seen the video of Khrushchev banging the shoe when he was at the UN. Basically, you'd have the East and the West, and you'd start the discussion with a set time of insults. So you're a capitalist, imperialist oppressors, and you are anti-democratic, dictatorial, blah, 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 blah. And when we were done changing insults, you got down to technical work and it got done. And so actually there was a great deal of cooperation at the technical level. A lot of international standards were made very successfully, including in ITU, but also elsewhere through East-West cooperation. Now it seems to go all the way down. you get down to some totally harmless technical protocol and it gets politicized and you start arguing. And you've also seen that with the COVID. So we focus on whether it was worse because China didn't talk soon enough about it or not. Yeah, okay, that's not exactly the pressing issue right now. We can come back to that in 2 or 3 years when we've sorted things out. So everything gets politicized. And I attribute that to the fact that before you had these two blocks, and then the Eastern Bloc disintegrated, and the U.S. had the illusion that it was going to be unipolar and dominate everything. But for various reasons, including U.S. internal politics, they don't have actually the will to be a global empire like the Romans used to be or the Brits at some stages. And so they're not exercising that role. So now you have these other powers popping up, some regional, some very low level, and a big one like China. And so now everybody's confused and you have this multipolar world. And so you just can't simply have the simple ideological discussion of communism versus capitalism, and it gets much more complicated. And so everything is quote unquote politicized. There's nothing wrong with politics per se, but there is when it's not moving forward and you're just bickering. And that's what we're seeing. So even things that everybody should agree on, I think everybody now agrees we should have security standards, like no brainers, right? Don't ship webcams with default password admin so that any idiot can hijack them, right? Don't do that. So it seems like a no brainer that we should agree to do that. If you don't like the ITU doing it, do it somewhere else. But the problem is the US always says, no, don't do it in forum X. And I've been in any number of forums where the proposal comes in, let's do something the US says and its allies, no, we don't want to do that here. Okay. But then you go to the next forum and they don't want to do that there either. Because they're still in this mode, the market will fix everything. So slowly we're getting out of that. I think on security, they're beginning to understand, no, the market isn't going to fix it. But as late as 10 years ago, the mantra from the US was, the market will fix it, right? Because users demand security, so the market will provide security. Because they're not seeing that there are market failures, which I mentioned, information asymmetry and externalities. So I'm really not optimistic about the ITU's ability to transform itself. What might work is that the ITU, as I mentioned, always grew by absorbing other things. So as you, because better than I, because you followed it much more closely than I do, now there's a push to enhance the IGF. To turn it into IGF plus kind of thing. If that works, then maybe in 20 years, that will then be attached to the ITU or the other way around. So people will say, wait a minute, this is all related. And so let's put it together because nobody's going to say that the IGF should have a development effort, whereas the ITU does. The ITU does a lot about trying to help developing countries build networks, et cetera. They'll say, wait a minute, if they're doing policy stuff there and development stuff there, wouldn't it be logical that they come together? So they might eventually in some future get merged. There was somebody proposed years ago, let's create an I sector in the ITU because they have a development sector, radio sector, and a telecommunications sector, let's create the internet sector, a whole new sector, maybe with different rules, and glue that in. If people actually wanted, if there were a will on the part of states to solve some of these issues, which at present there really isn't, although it's beginning to come, there would be the mechanism to do that. And that's what I outlined in what you said. I'm proposing a treaty, which is to some extent cut and paste. For example, I took Brad Smith, the chief executive officer of Microsoft's idea that we need a Geneva Digital Convention, he called it, because we know that one of the issues is that states, it's primarily the US, but for sure the Russians, the Chinese, and probably the English and the Germans and some others are doing it too, and the French, they're stockpiling, and the Israelis, they're stockpiling malware. Because they want to be able to use that either for cyber defense or cyber attack. Guess what? The stuff leaks. And when it leaks, the bad guys use it. So WannaCry came from that, and NotPetya came from that. These were US stockpiles that got into the black market and were used by criminals. So Brad Smith basically said, look, states should agree not to stockpile malware, number one, and number two, to disclose faults as soon as they find them. So not have zero-day faults where I know about the fault and I'm going to exploit it. But then, you know, nobody else can fix it until after it's become public. So that's one element. The other elements are basic infrastructure and monetization of data, et cetera, that we've discussed. And if there were a will to do that, you know, people say it takes forever to negotiate a treaty. That's because people don't agree. If people agree, it's fairly easy to negotiate a treaty. It's not done in a day. Obviously, it takes 2 to 3 years. But once you have the agreement on what to do, you get the experts together, you hammer out the words, and you do that. And the ITU actually would be the perfect framework or shell organization in which to do that. The ITU is, there's not some giant staff that is running things, which some people criticize ICANN for. I don't know how true that is, but in the case of the ITU, the staff is extremely weak. It's really the member states. It's the membership that's running things. So if the membership were willing to do that, it would be a good framework. The staff is basically organized meeting, publishing documents, and you know, and stuff like that. And the ITU does have this plenipotentiary conference, which meets every 4 years, which is a treaty-making conference. It's unusual, right? Most treaty-making conferences are ad hoc. You have to actually convene it, convince everybody to call one, and so on. Whereas the ITU has this convenient regular mechanism. Every 4 years, they can make treaties. And that conference could call for a sub-conference called the World Conference on International Telecommunications, which the last one was in 2012 with some rather strange results. But basically, they could call for another wicket and give it a four-year preparation period, and then everybody could come together and do all of the wonderful things that I've outlined in the treaty. But it's really a lack of will. So it comes back to your fundamental question. Could ITU do it? Theoretically, yes. In practice, no, because there's no will to do that. Paradoxically, though, and I put that in my paper, just put the knife in and turn it, the dominant states, which are, of course, the US and the its allies, the other OECD states, are calling for binding treaty-level provisions in the WTO, precisely on the topics that they refuse to discuss in the ITU. So, for example, they want to use the WTO to have treaty provisions on spam when they refuse to have any discussion of treaty provisions on spam in the ITU or security. Wait a minute. Since when are trade negotiators the right people to negotiate treaty-level provisions on spam? What they're proposed is not bad. I don't have a problem with the substance, but it's just the thought that this is ridiculous, right? If you're going to try to do something about spam at treaty level, that is, as an intergovernmental agreement, at least do it in the institution where, first of all, industry can participate directly, civil society to some extent. It's not great, but it's better than zero. And you have experts, the people from the governments who actually might know something about spam, as opposed to trade negotiators who know nothing about spam. And by the way, the WTO is the most closed international organization of any because it has no provision whatsoever for formal participation by non-state actors. And that's a deliberate choice, which they still maintain today. Whereas you can argue the ITU is not sufficiently open, the UN is not sufficiently open, blah, blah, but they have some provision. So does WIPO, they all do, except WTO. WTO is a zero space for non-state actors. And also at the national level, if you've ever tried to work with the people at the national level who do WTO, they're very closed. So for example, from the Swiss ITU representatives, you know, the Swiss government, I can get anything I want. The WTO people won't even talk to me at the national level.
Wow.
And so just to close that, and so in my paper, I say, look, apparently there is a will to negotiate treaties because you're trying to do it in WTO. Now, what you're trying to do, first of all, it's the wrong venue. And second of all, it's the wrong content because what you're trying to do is actually enshrine the free flow of data and continue allowing Zuckerberg and company to make monopoly profits. Forget that. Here's something better. And by the way, you could do that in ITU if you wanted to.
This has been a fascinating conversation. Richard Hill, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. I really enjoyed it.
That was Richard Hill. Next week on Power Plays, we'll be interviewing the angel investor, Esther Dyson.
This has been Power Plays, the podcast that takes you inside the rooms and into the minds of the decision makers responsible for some of the most instrumental decisions that help shape the internet, which we all use today. If you'd like to help us spread the word, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe. We're available on every major listening app, as well as at powerplays.xyz.